Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Last fall, the USDA, U.S. Department of Agriculture, released its annual report on hunger in America. It found that over 36 million people, and that is 1 in 8 Americans, were food insecure at some time during the year 2007, and that was even before the current economic slowdown. This morning, in this hour of the show, we'll be talking with Joel Berg. He is a nationally known anti-poverty advocate, and we'll be talking about hunger in America. He says that this is essentially a political problem, and that all of the worst features of American politics have all come together to prevent us from ending it. We'll be talking about some of what you will find in his book, All You Can Eat, How Hungry Is America? It is published by Seven Stories Press. It's a paperback, and if you're interested in reading more on this issue, you can go and seek the book out. Our guest is executive director of the New York City Coalition Against Hunger and has had that job since 2001. And if you're interested in the coalition and its activities and you have internet access, they do indeed have a website, so you can take a look at that. Before taking up this job, he served 2 years as USDA Coordinator of Community Food Security. That was a new position in which he created and implemented the first ever federal initiative to better enable faith-based and other nonprofits to fight hunger, to bolster food security, and also to help low-income Americans move from poverty to self-sufficiency. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions from listeners are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of people who call in is just that people try to keep their comments brief so we can get as many as possible in and keep moving along. But if you'd like to call in, be a part of the conversation, you can certainly do that. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are certainly welcome. Mr. Berg, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Something I think is really interesting, you begin the book with a little bit of a story talking about talking with someone in Africa, having a conversation with someone in, I think it was said that it was in Mali. And,
yes.
And one could easily imagine having the same conversation with somebody else somewhere in the developing world about America and how people in countries like that have a hard time with the notion, have a hard time actually believing that anybody in America could possibly be hungry. Here, you know, these are people that you would expect would have some personal experience. But as far as they're concerned, America, well, how could such a thing be? It's the richest country in the world. And it seems that's an attitude that not only do people in the developing world have, but there are a lot of Americans who don't have any idea just to what extent this is a problem in this country.
Absolutely, and that's precisely why I chose to open the book with that story. When I was in Bamako, the capital of Mali, West Africa, I knew it was a country that was desperately poor. The average income is a few hundred dollars for the year. And the gentleman who was talking to me had a hard time understanding that there could be any problem in America, and I made 2 points. Number one, hunger in America is relative. We don't have people starving in the streets anymore like we used to because we have a federal nutrition safety net, such as food stamps, school meals, the Women's, Infants, and Children program. It's not as robust as it should be as a safety net, and that's why we have this unique problem of food insecurity in America, of people choosing between food and rent, people rationing food. That's what hunger in America is more commonly like. But also that in a subsistence economy, you need food. You go out and hunt it or gather it. You need heat for your hut. You chop down a tree. Here in America, you can be making minimum wage or slightly more than minimum wage and make $24,000 a year. But in New York City, where I live, you can easily pay that money in a low-income neighborhood for rent alone. So if you're paying in rent what you've already earned for the whole year, you and your spouse, perhaps you have no money left over for clothing, no money left over for school books for your kids, and no money left over for food.
Well, let's talk about some numbers. Here, the USDA has been gathering and presenting these numbers since, I think, maybe about the mid-90s.
Yeah,
and being a large bureaucratic organization, sometimes it can be a little confusing. I'm sure they think they're being precise, but sometimes I think it actually makes things more cloudy, particularly if you toss around a term like food insecurity. I think some people would say, well, what exactly does that mean, food insecurity?
Well, I'm the first to say it's a horribly wonkish term, a horribly academic term, and I was at the Department of Agriculture and was involved in explaining it to the country. But as bad as the term is, I think it's useful because it helps set the stage that we don't have the same problem as the third world. It's a hunger and food insecurity in the American context. The formal definition is people not having secured access to a sufficient supply of food. I put it this way, people not able to afford all the nutritious food they need, people one or two setbacks away from hunger, people at the brink of hunger, people juggling hunger. And that's what hunger in America is more likely to be than a kid just going a week without any food at all. After all, they're likely to at least get school lunches. But even the level of food insecurity we have in America today, and in Illinois, it's vast. Mm-hmm. Between 2002 and 2004, about 9% of the people in Illinois were food insecure. And the last time this was measured, 2005 to 2007, it had jumped to 9.5% of the population. So a lot of people think, oh, this is just a really poor inner city thing, or in Appalachia, it's just the homeless folks. But 1 out of 10 Illinois residents almost live in homes that can't afford enough food. And that level of hunger, that level of food insecurity in America costs our economy $90 billion a year we lose because hungry children don't learn well enough, hungry workers don't work as productively as nourished workers, and healthcare costs rise dramatically because of hunger and food security, and ironically, because food insecurity actually leads to obesity, because the poorest people often cannot afford the most nutritious food, and they have to go to the least nutritious, most filling food. So the greatest irony of all is that hunger and obesity are often flip sides of the same malnutrition coin in America.
Yeah, and that's something that I think that perhaps may be surprising to people, but the reality is that the most the affordable food in this country, the cheapest food, is probably the least healthy. And we, constantly we're getting this message about what a healthy diet is and what we should be eating. Well, the sad fact is that the healthiest food is often the most expensive.
And people might think, well, downstate Illinois, it's the breadbasket of America. Surely there's enough nutritious food there. But the truth is, as you know, many farmers don't even have their own gardens anymore. So there's an overall problem with health and nutrition in America, but low-income people have it doubly rough. First, they can't afford the most nutritious food, and in many rural areas, in many urban areas, there are so-called food deserts where nutritious food doesn't even exist. You can't physically buy it.
Let me just very quickly introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580, Joel Berg. He's the executive director of the New York City Coalition Against Hunger and someone who is well known as an activist in the fields of hunger and food security. He is the author of the book All You Can Eat, How Hungry Is America, that deals with the subject. It's available in paper, published by the Seven Stories Press. If you'd like to look at it, also questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Just to go back again to the term food insecurity, we talked about a very large number of people here, and I would imagine that from person to person, from family to family, the situation can be a little bit different. Just can you, in a more concrete sort of a way, talk about, well, what really are the conditions that families are having to deal with, and in a practical sort of way, when you say that somebody might be food insecure, well, what exactly does that mean?
Sure. I'll give you a very concrete example. A school official in New York City told me he saw a school kid rummaging through a dumpster to get extra food. A person in New York told me they were at a Starbucks eating a muffin, and someone sort of quietly sidled up next to them, and very quietly, after they started to get up to leave, started eating the crumbs off their plate. A woman in West Philadelphia told me the other day that she gets limited food from food stamps, limited food from food pantries. And as bad off as she is, she sometimes gives food to her neighbors who are even worse off. I tell the story in the book of cancer patients in rural Kentucky who have to choose between cancer medicine and food. So what it is people rationing food, buying less food than their family might need, occasionally skipping meals, certainly getting the cheapest, more filling food. It's often parents going without food so their kids can get food. It's literally having to decide with that last bit of your paycheck whether you pay the rent or face eviction or pay for food. In New York City, much of the rest of the country, homelessness has been skyrocketing, and that's directly related to food insecurity. So it's people going through tough choices every day. Now, some conservatives say, well, boy, if they don't go whole days without eating, we're just fine. It's better than Somalia, so what are you complaining about, you activist, you? And I explain in the book, I actually lived for a week on a food stamps diet, which is the amount of money you could get in New York at the time. The average allotment was $28.30 for the week. And with my partner at home shopping to buy stuff, she could cook from scratch and taking hours sometimes for each meal, we could scrape by on that. But I got to tell you, I was obsessed with where my next meal was coming from, and I knew I was getting it. So even if the conservatives are right, which they're not, but even if they're right, if this is me worrying about getting enough food, I would suggest that for any human being not knowing for sure where your next meal is going to come from is absolutely psychologically debilitating. There is very else little in life you could possibly do under that condition.
One other question, and then I have a caller I want to get to. Over time, that is over the last few decades, it seems that awareness on this issue has risen and fallen. And in part, I think when it rises, it's because of activities of people like you and organizations that are really concerned with this issue, trying to build public awareness. But is it the case, if you chart it out over time, as you have and other people have, is this problem about the same as it was, say, in the 1980s? Is it worse than it was in the 1980s?
Perhaps the most important point of my book is that it is not a fixed problem over time. If people believe that, then they'll believe, well, the best we can do is help with a little charity. It was much worse in the Great Depression. We reduced it dramatically because of the growth of the Federal Nutrition Assistance Safety Net. With the real expansion of those programs over the 60s and 70s, we almost entirely wiped out hunger in America. And yet in the 80s, when Ronald Reagan convinced the country that we could get by without living wage jobs and convinced the country that trickle-down economics would somehow trickle down to the poor, convinced the country that underfunded private charities could do the job better than government, it was at that time when we had the real modern explosion of homelessness and this much larger problem of hunger. So today in America, it's 36.2 million Americans. And sometimes people who don't suffer from the problem go, it's a hidden problem. And my response is always, hidden to who? It's not hidden to 36.2 million Americans. That's a population far larger than the population of Illinois. That's a population about as large as California. So it's only a hidden problem to some who don't know about it, or sometimes the media doesn't report on it. In the late 60s, before we had the growth of the safety net, there were a few dozen network TV news stories on hunger in 69 and 68. Most of the years since then, as I document in the book, there was not a single network TV story on hunger. Out of sight is out of mind to the elites, and that has a direct influence on public policy. When it's not in the news, when people aren't agitating for change, our elected officials tend to do less. I will say there are exceptions for the rules, and I'm not just sucking up because I'm talking to an Illinois radio station. Former Senator Obama, now the president, has done a lot on this issue, and Senator Durbin is a real national champion on the hunger issue. So I must say people in Illinois are pretty lucky to have some champions.
All right. Well, let's talk with the caller here. It was first up is Bloomington, Indiana, our line four, the toll-free line. Hello.
Hi. I want to ask about food expiration dates. They're usually called sell-by dates. You know what I'm talking about?
I do.
Okay. Now, this sell-by date, it's stamped on the packaged foods, and if the food is not sold by that sell-by date, the supermarket has to throw it away. And of course, well, once we get food home, it may be well after the sell-by date before we eat it. I know that I have eaten food that is well past its sell-by date, and I can't taste any difference in that food than food that I've eaten before the expiration date. And yet supermarkets have to throw that food away if it goes past the sell-by date and it's not sold off their shelves. And it seems to me that's a terrible waste of food. I do know you were talking about people who populate the dumpsters, who get food out of the dumpsters. Some of that food is dumped in the dumpsters behind a supermarket because the sell-by date has expired, and that's perfectly wholesome food. I would eat it. And so why don't we eliminate this sell-by date? Isn't that the cause of a great deal of food being just wasted?
I would not favor eliminating sell-by dates, because I can tell you, when I worked at the Department of Agriculture in the 90s, my first day of work, literally my first day of work at the department, I was then communications director for the department, a child died of E. coli poisoning in the Pacific Northwest from a poisoned burger at a Jack in the Box, and there were other deaths in the region. So the only thing I suppose that I would say is worse than people having to ration food is people dying of bad food. And so if there's ever a tie, I'm going to err on the side of food safety, because particularly for children, particularly for senior citizens, this can literally mean life and death, as we've seen with the recent salmonella problem. That being said, the broader problem is that our food safety system in America is broken, and there's essentially no differentiation between the sell-by dates, which can mean a matter of life and death, versus the sell-by dates, which are basically cosmetic or arbitrary.
Yeah.
So I am not, you know, a food safety expert, but I'd be a heck of a lot more concerned personally about the sell-by dates on milk or meat than I would be, let's say, on a box of cereal. The cereal may be a little more stale, but doesn't mean you're going to die for it. That being said, a lot of supermarkets do donate food very near their expiration dates to food banks and food rescue organizations around the country. So some of that goes to waste, but a lot of that does go to feed hungry and food insecure Americans.
Well, now, wouldn't it be just as dangerous? You're talking about salmonella and certain infections. Wouldn't it be just as dangerous for people to take that food home? It stays on the shelf in their cupboard for a while, and then they eat it after the sell-by date. Wouldn't the danger of infection be just as great?
Absolutely, and that's why my personal opinion, this isn't my area of expertise, but I know more about than most folks, that we do need an overhaul of the entire food safety system, and those sell-by dates should be much clearer. Does this date mean danger? Or does this mean that it's just going to be a little less tasty? Many of us would have a marginally less tasty food than having to buy whole new food, but I think we'd also want to know if it's on our refrigerator or our freezer, how safe it is. And I think perhaps it makes sense to have a sell-by date and a use-by date, which are two different things.
Yeah. I appreciate the caller's questions. I have some other folks here. I guess, it comes around to this question. Do we know that we, in this country, waste a lot of food? Would it be conceivable to try to come up with a better way than we do now of trying to recover food that we know would be safe to eat, but it otherwise would be thrown away, that could be made available to people who need it?
We've actually made a lot of progress in that area over the last few decades. And when I was at the Department of Agriculture, one of my jobs is I was in charge of an initiative called the Food Recovery and Gleaning Initiative, where it was the first time the federal government really encouraged donation of excess food. So we made a lot of progress having farmers donate excess food that couldn't be sold, supermarkets doing more, restaurants donating that pan of lasagna that wasn't served. But even though we have a fair amount of food waste in the country and we can still donate a little more, we're coming close to the saturation point where most of the food that's relatively economical and safe to donate is being donated. And I would say to go beyond that, we're not going to make major dents in the hunger problem without doing something different. And in my realm, that something different is serious federal intervention, not just by getting excess food, but getting people the power to do what all Americans want, to be able to walk into a grocery store with money they earned and buy the food they need.
We have some other callers here, and then let's talk next with someone in Paris. That's line number one. Hello.
Yeah, good afternoon. Good morning.
Yes.
I you answered a couple of my questions with the last caller about, you know, the issue of food from the grocery stores being put into the dumpsters. I have great concern that some of our bigger markets, they have a tendency to take stuff and put it in the dumpster, then make sure that the homeless can't eat it because they dump stuff on it to make it inedible. The other thing that I was wondering, and this might be just kind of off the wall, but we have such problems with deer and stuff like that, and it's such a good protein source that it seems kind of confusing to me that we don't allow hunters to harvest more than we already do, because it's getting to be a real bad issue, especially here in Edgar County, to donate that food, that meat to the poor, you know, just to have a program where we have a day set aside where the hunters do go out and they hunt just strictly for donation towards the poor. And the other thing is, I really wish that we would see more programs geared towards the schools of teaching kids how to raise food. We have so many kids, especially in the urban areas now, that haven't got a clue how to raise a garden, how to raise a tomato plant in a pot, much less, you know, how to preserve it to use, you know, after the season's over with. And I really wish we'd see more programs geared to that. And I'll listen to your comments offline. Thank you.
All right. Well,
those are great points. For one other point I'd make about food donations is, during the Clinton administration, President Clinton negotiated with Congress the passage of a new law, and this was government working in a bipartisan fashion the way it does on its best days, a bipartisan law that protects good faith donors from being successfully sued if in good faith they donate food. That's called the Bill Emerson Good Samaritan Food Donation Act, named after a wonderful late congressman from Missouri. So that's one thing. Two, there are programs called Hunters for the Hungry that have collected venison and helped process that. There is some money involved in the processing of it, and particularly the safe processing of venison, but I would certainly support expansion of those programs. I worked for a Democratic administration that didn't always agree with the National Rifle Association on handgun control, and yet we worked together with the NRA on ensuring that excess venison could be donated by hunters. So I think that's another lesson. Even if you don't agree with some folks on one issue, you can certainly come together over the need to feed your hungry neighbors. And I fully agree that schools should do more to promote gardens. I am thrilled of the new Secretary of Agriculture, USDA Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack, just announced that USDA is going to have some garden production at every USDA facility around the U.S. and around the globe, and I think that's certainly a good role model for schools. The volume of food produced by schools in rooftop gardens or community gardens probably isn't going to be vast. But, as the caller suggests, the educational impact of having children grow their own food not only is good biological education, it's certainly good nutrition education. I certainly hope all levels of government do more to promote that.
We are in our midpoint here. We have some other callers we'll get right to, but I would like to introduce again our guest for anyone who might have tuned in the last 10, 15 minutes. Joel Berg is a nationally recognized leader in the fields of hunger, food security, and national and community service. He is the author of the book All You Can Eat, How Hungry Is America? Looking at this issue. It's published by Seven Stories Press, just came out last fall. He currently serves as the executive director of the New York City Coalition Against Hunger, which represents the city's more than 1,200 soup kitchens and food pantries. Before joining the coalition, he served in senior executive service positions at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. That was for 8 years, between 1999 and 2001. He acted as, during that time, one of the things he did, he acted as coordinator of community food security. And he created and implemented the first ever federal government initiative to enable faith-based and other nonprofits to fight hunger, bolster food security, and help low-income Americans move from poverty to self-sufficiency. That's something that he continues to be involved in. So again, questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. One thing that I wonder about is to what extent are schools involved in this issue because they are providing meals for kids?
School meals are a vital part of our fight against hunger. As I point out in the book, school meals programs in America were first created at the national level as a defense strategy. Following World War II, generals came to President Truman and said, "Mr. President, our boys are too malnourished to fight. I don't want to sound sexist, but at the time, most of the people doing the physical combat were boys. And as a result, President Truman and some very conservative members of Congress created the school lunch program, and that has had a very significant impact on eliminating third-world-style starvation in America. However, today, 80% of the children eligible for free breakfasts in America don't get it. There are a lot of reasons. There are logistical reasons that sometimes the breakfast time is so early, parents can't disrupt their entire schedule to get the kids there early. Often there's a tremendous stigma that breakfast is in a separate room and kids would have to essentially announce to all their peers that they're poor and hungry in order to get that help. So one of the things we've been promoting is serving breakfast in the first period classroom and saying every kid gets it. Just like every kid would get a school book because that's an educational tool, every kid would get a breakfast. We've done it in New York City in pilot projects. It's worked incredibly well, and it really doesn't cost a whole lot more money because even though you're buying more meals, you're reducing the paperwork that we have now that creates a tremendous bureaucracy to collect all these forms to determine whether a kid's very poor and gets a free breakfast, sort of poor and gets to reduce price breakfast, or not exactly poor and has to pay the full price. So by reducing bureaucracy, you can actually feed more kids, and that's something that we're really pushing for nationwide.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's talk with some other callers. Next to someone in Urbana, here where we are. This is line two. Hello?
Yes. The caller a while back from Indiana, in regard to his comments, the problem isn't that there isn't enough food. The problem is some people can't afford it, and therefore making more food available doesn't even begin to approach the problem. It's misdirected. Pardon me. I seem to be losing my voice, but I'll go on. Food that's over date, past the expiration date, if it's packaged or canned, probably is not going to be dangerous, and I should put that in quotation marks, but its nutritive value declines. And if there were no expiration date, presumably it could be held 10 years and still sold, when it would be very little nutritive value, and it might even become dangerous. I hope those comments are of some value. Mm. Well, in general, I agree with you completely.
And I think I appreciate the comments of the caller. And Joel Berg, you might want to deal particularly with the first point, because I think that what a lot of people would say is that's really the central issue here, is we can talk about trying to make food available at low or no cost to people who can't afford it, but that's the proverbial Band-Aid solution, and that what we're really doing there is we're treating a symptom, but we're really not getting at what is the problem.
Absolutely. And that is a central and perhaps most controversial point of my book, that America has sort of been, may I say, conned into believing that this massive charitable response we have through food banks and food pantries and soup kitchens are somehow solving the problem. Don't get me wrong, these agencies are doing heroic work. They should be supported, but I don't think anyone should be fooled into thinking they're solving the problem. The problem's getting worse because there is no way a major national problem could or should be solved by part-time, underfunded, volunteer-run charities. When there's a major national problem, it's the government working on behalf of the citizens that needs to address the problem. As the caller pointed out, there's never been a problem with lack of food in America. Even in the Great Depression, despite the Dust Bowl, the biggest agricultural problem was overproduction of food that crashed prices and the fact that Americans were too poor to be able to buy it. So I've actually calculated painstakingly in the book that if you doubled all the charitable food distribution in America, increased it by 200%, which is a ridiculous, impossible goal. Given this recession, we'd be lucky to increase it by 5% in any given year, no less, you know, hold off decreases. But let's say you were able to accomplish a miracle and increase charitable food donations, everything, every food bank, soup kitchen, food pantry, food cupboard, church, synagogue, mosque in America did on the charitable end. That would decrease hunger in America from about 35 million people to about 32 million people, barely a dent in the problem. And yet, if you increase the federal nutrition assistance safety net by 41%, you could entirely eliminate the problem. So a 200% increase in charity would barely dent the problem, but a 41% increase in government efforts would end the problem. I would suggest common sense would say that we ought to be focusing a little more on government doing its part.
Mm-hmm. And how much more money would that involve spending than we're spending now?
About a year ago, before the worst of the economic collapse, I calculated it would be about $24 billion a year, which at the time sounded enormous, but I pointed out that equaled about 3 months of warfare in Iraq, or about 6% of the president's tax cuts. Now that we've been throwing out around these larger numbers, I can say it's about 2% of the Wall Street bailout. And I can see my audience is nodding their head. They agree with me that if we could spend $1 trillion on bailing out Wall Street, we can spend $24 billion on ending hunger in America. As I pointed out, because that costs our society $90 billion a year, it is the best investment in our future ever to spend $24 billion preventing the problem.
All right, let's talk with the caller in the community of Belgium, not all that far away from us here, line number four. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. You've touched on the topic, the question I was going to ask just a few minutes ago, and I'd like to flesh it out just a little bit more for you. My wife was a school teacher for 35 years here in East Central Illinois. When she started teaching school, nobody got free lunches in her classes. Nobody. We lived in a community that pretty much was affluent enough that nobody really had to depend upon one. When she retired 35 years later, over 50% of her class, almost all of them, got free lunches or reduced-cost lunches. And you could always tell the ones that were not going to miss school were the ones that were the hungriest. They always came for the morning breakfast. They ate all their lunches, and they took a sack lunch home at night. They really needed it. It's a program that we should improve on much more. Thank you.
I agree with you. One clarification, there are some schools that have a special backpack program that people take food home. Is that what you're referring to?
Yes, sir.
Oh, okay. Just want to be clear, because I did work for the federal government, always very careful that the regular school lunch program, technically kids aren't allowed to take the food home, but there are these other backpack programs. But you raise a more important point. That, you know, a lot of your listeners probably think, oh, this is a problem for East St. Louis. This is a problem for Chicago. This isn't a problem for downstate Illinois. I grew up in Rockland County, New York, about 20 miles north of New York City, which was a leasy middle-class suburb when I was growing up. I'm 44 now. But now Rockland County has doubled its poverty rate in the last few decades. It has more soup kitchens and food pantries per capita than New York City. And there's been a fundamental change in the American economy over the last few decades. It used to be that people working full-time may have been marginally poor, but their families certainly didn't face hunger. And because of the collapse of living wage manufacturing jobs and being replaced by non-living wage service economy jobs, places like your caller was talking about that didn't have a problem just a few decades ago have very serious problems now. So this isn't just a problem of a few poor people going hungry. This is something systematically wrong with the American economy and American social welfare system and safety net.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. To someone else, I think we're going to have another caller. Let me just very quickly again introduce the guest for this hour, Focus 580, Joel Berg. He is the executive director of the New York City Coalition Against Hunger, and before joining the coalition, he worked for a number of years at the U.S. Department of Agriculture from 1999 to 2001, did a number of things. He acted as coordinator of community food security. He's the author of the book, All You Can Eat, How Hungry Is America? It's published by the Seven Stories Press. It's available in paper now, so if you're interested in reading up on the issue, you can do that. Also, if you'd like to find out more about the New York City Coalition Against Hunger, they have a website, and you can take a look at that. A little bit earlier, we talked about how difficult it is to make food stamps work for you because the amount of money that's provided is really quite small. You can do it, but it's very challenging. And that seems to me, and you correct me if I'm wrong, that seems to me of all the government programs that are available to address this issue, that's the biggest one.
In terms of amount of money.
In terms of the amount of money
it
spent.
It dwarfs all the others.
And it also happens to, and this is something that I think maybe would surprise people, it also makes up a very large chunk of the budget of the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
The federal nutrition assistance programs comprise 62% of USDA's budget. although ironically only about 1% of USDA staff, because unlike farm programs or rural economic development programs, which are run by and large at the county level by USDA employees out of federal offices, these federal programs are actually run by states and counties out of state and county offices on the federal nutrition side.
Well, when you do talk about it and how we might address this program, if we put more money into food stamps, would that be important? Would it be significant? And how much would we have to increase that for that really to make a difference?
Well, if you give me a choice between spending more money on food stamps or less money on food stamps, I am going to advocate fiercely every time for more money for food stamps. And we are very glad that the stimulus bill about to be passed by Congress and signed into law by the President has a significant increase in food stamps. But here's where I differ with some of my peers in the advocacy community. I don't think it's just good enough to spend more money on existing programs. They're far better than the programs not existing. Most of the programs work spectacularly well in getting rid of third world style starvation in America, but there's still too much bureaucracy in the programs. There are too many overlapping programs, and it's too difficult for low income people to apply. They often have to spend a day or two or three applying for each of the programs, often losing work to prove to the government they're virtuous enough to get help. So I've proposed actually combining all the federal nutrition assistance programs, keeping their benefits intact, but using the savings from the administrative combination to actually increase their benefits, having one application for all the federal nutrition assistance programs, having one office that people have to go to or one internet site they can submit their application, their documentation over. So I would think this would get broad support. It achieved the conservative goal of reducing the number of government employees needed, reducing bureaucracy, reducing paperwork, empowering families. And after all, food stamps benefits, which are now called SNAP, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program benefits, really are a voucher, which conservatives say they're for. So it achieves the conservative goal of reducing bureaucracy and the progressive goal of getting more help to poor people. So I do think that kind of reform, along with more focus on getting people benefits, should be something that would be widely embraced by people of a wide variety of ideologies and parties.
Okay. Let's talk with someone, another caller here, someone in Champaign. This will be on our line 4. Hello.
Oh, southwest of Champaign.
Oh, as well? Go ahead, please.
I know when my aunt was getting food from a handout at one of the churches, they put certain things in the box, and that's what you got. Well, they ought to, in that case, there were some things that she wouldn't eat, so she should have been able to give that back instead of taking it home and trying to find somebody that could eat it. And that's one of the problems, too.
Thank you so much for that point, ma'am. That's an important point. Again, we as Americans love the idea of charity being able to solve every problem. But I ask people to put themselves in the place of a food recipient. And which would you rather prefer for your family? That you just get a pre-packed bag of food that someone else decided what your family needs, or it's based on what some company had left over to donate? So you've never baked a pie in your life. You don't like pie. You may not even have an oven to bake pie, and you get a pie crust. And that is the problem with the charitable food distribution system. With the food stamps program, you're able to get this voucher from the government, get these credits from the government. You go into a supermarket, and you make the choice for your own family what you need most. There's a lot less waste in the program, and at least the theoretical ability of people to eat a lot more nutritiously. And so I kind of laugh when conservatives attack the food stamps program. In some ways, it's a more conservative program than food pantries and soup kitchens because it's using the private free market system to allow people to buy food. Pantries and kitchens actually develop an alternative, duplicative system to the free market system. So I know people laugh when I say this, but I actually argue that food stamps are less liberal than food pantries or soup kitchens.
All right. Well, again, I want to thank the caller. I mean, that certainly underlines the problem that food pantries and other organizations that do that have, and that is they're dependent on – they may indeed have a little bit of money. If people give them money, that they can then go out and buy something if they see a particular need. But other than that, they're really dependent on what anybody's going to give them. And that's something that they just don't have any choice or control over. And they might get, you know, stuff that's really of marginal appeal to a large number of people.
Now, I must say, some of the better funded and better staffed pantries around the country have developed a client choice model where they actually allow people to shop. They get a point system. You can get this many points, and people actually pack their own bags based on what they need. If a pantry has enough food, has enough staff, has enough volunteers to do that, more power to them. But as you said, they are dependent on what's donated, or a lot of their food is government food. And that drives me nuts as well, that people say, oh, well, these private pantries and kitchens are much better than this horrible government food stamp program, when in fact much of the food given out by these pantries and kitchens is government food to begin with. But unfortunately, too often the government buys the food based on sort of agribusiness or congressional politics, if I may, who's yelling the loudest at the Secretary of Agriculture they should buy this food, and less on the nutritional value of the food. So whether it's government food or donated food, sometimes it's nutritious, but more often than not, it's not as nutritious as people need.
Mm. Well, again, we have about 7-8 minutes left in this hour focus. Our guest is Joel Berg. He is the executive director of the New York City Coalition Against Hunger. He's author of the book that deals with the issue of hunger in America. The title of his book is All You Can Eat, How Hungry Is America, published by the Seven Stories Press. It came out last fall, and it is in bookstores now, or maybe you can seek it out in the library if you'd like to read on the subject. Questions also welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Just to go back to the, I'm interested in, you know, the fact that one of the things that you did with USDA was try to help faith-based group, nonprofits who want to work with this, who want to work on this issue. And I suppose that some people would say, well, why not just if we, rather than have so much involvement of the government in this, wouldn't it make more sense for these groups that are already doing it, they kind of know what they're doing, if we could just give them more resources, we could actually take care of the problem that way rather than increasing federal government involvement?
The very first people to tell you that they can solve the problem are the faith-based leaders. The vast majority of church leaders who run pantries and kitchens, as well as, you know, synagogue and mosque leaders who run charitable feeding program, will all say that they shouldn't and couldn't solve a problem government should be doing. They will never have enough resources. They will never be open enough hours. They will never have the ability to make the determinations on behalf of the people what should get done. And, you know, I run a nonprofit organization. I'm obviously not dissing nonprofit organizations, but I was picked by a board of directors of 9 people, all fine, upstanding people, but no one from the public elected them. Whatever you think of elected officials, they were elected by the people. Now, Illinois is a funny case. I won't go there.
But no, we won't talk about that.
And New York now, we have a governor who wasn't elected governor and a senator who wasn't elected senator. But in general, elected officials are elected by the people, so they have a lot more legitimacy to deal with this on behalf of society. That being said, I break with some of my friends on sort of the more progressive side. I've spent a lot of this interview, you know, criticizing conservatives. I'll criticize some knee-jerk liberals who automatically blasted Obama for even talking about a faith-based initiative as if he was just aping what Bush did. But as you noted, I work with faith-based and secular groups in the Clinton administration. The question isn't whether faith-based agencies are going to be involved in social services and get government funding. They have for decades. The question is whether they're effective and whether government aid is used to discriminate or proselytize. In the Clinton administration, government aid wasn't used to discriminate or proselytize. It was in the Bush administration, and now it seems clear that the Obama administration is not going to allow that to happen. People are free to proselytize with their own money. That's how it's worked throughout American history, but not with government funds. So really the idea in my mind is to have a balance. I think the balance is out of skew, that government has placed too much focus on these agencies, given them the problem without giving them the resources to solve the problem. So I say, let's go back to a time where government does what it does best. And I say, grinding out sort of McBenefits, making sure people have adequate food, housing, health care, child care. And then nonprofit groups can go back to doing what we do best, doing innovative new projects, helping individuals as individuals, really specializing in the unique problems of the communities. But nonprofits like mine and soup kitchens and food pantries and churches across the country can never do that successfully as long as we're doing what we're doing now, treading water just to help people meet their basic needs. So I just think we need a balance.
Yeah. We have a couple of minutes left here. We have some other callers, so we'll try to get at least a couple in the time that remains. And next is someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello. Yes, I've got a couple points. Actually, we have very good food pantry and soup kitchen activism in this community, but in my experience as a volunteer, we throw out far too much number three damaged food, non-hazardous, in my opinion, a great waste, and I've complained about this for years, and I will continue to complain. I wonder if you could explain to the audience the federal guidelines for one, two, and three damaged food. And second point, are you familiar with William H. Shore's book, Revolution of the Heart? And I'll get off and listen. Thank you.
Billy Shore from Shore Strength? Who you're talking about, it's a great national group we work with, and it's a wonderful book. He's written a number of wonderful books about how to attack the hunger problem. I'm not familiar with the details of the one, two, or three cans that the gentleman raises, but I'll say this. It's not always obvious the difference between a bulging can, which could mean botulism and death, and a dented can, which is a perfectly healthy can that someone just hit against a wall as they were shipping it. And again, you know, given the stakes are so high that people really can die from these foodborne illnesses, we err on the side of the caution. So it's heartbreaking to throw out good food. But I do think the federal government needs to do a much better job of helping people distinguish food that's just cosmetically damaged versus food that could be poisonous. That's not always easy to see. You know, pathogens and germs are invisible, and they often have no taste or smell, but I do think with modern biological testing methods, the federal government could do a lot better job.
All right. Next is someone on a cell phone, line three. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Joel, I was hoping that you could elaborate a little bit more on, you said earlier that with a couple years ago you had calculated that $26 billion could eliminate the problem, but 200% increase in private donations or private charity work would only put a dent a few million people. Could you elaborate exactly why that is? I mean, if it's just the scale of the funding or...
It is the scale and the infrastructure. You know, in New York City and most of the country, pantries are only open once or twice a month. I don't know about you. I like eating all 30 days out of the month. I've roughly calculated that all the charities in America distribute maybe $3 or $2 billion worth of food a year, which is enormous, but the Federal Nutrition Safety Net is $59 billion a year. So a lot of the media attention is on the holiday food drives and the scouts and the post delivery people collecting food. But in total, the truth is that is dwarfed by the Federal Nutrition System Safety Net. So if the charitable food's about $2 billion and the safety net is about $60 billion, the federal response is 30 times the volume of the food distributed by these pantries and kitchens. If you really wanted these charities to ramp up to scale, the amount of money that would have to be spent to pay for the rent, to pay for the heat, to pay for the staff, because volunteers can't work 30 days out of the week to expand these charitable agencies to meet the need, that would probably be a heck of a lot more money than the $24 billion needed to expand the federal safety net.
We are almost at the point where we have to finish, and I apologize. We have a couple of callers I don't think we're going to be able to take. One just last point I'd like to give you the chance to make, because I certainly know that you do in the book, and I'm sure it's something that you talk about a lot, and that is the fact that this problem that we've been talking about is a solvable problem, and it's mostly a matter of political will, deciding that we want to do something about it. And that's something I'm sure that you would say in the past has been lacking.
If we almost ended hunger in the 1970s. We can end hunger if we just have the political will. I go into the book how Americans ended cholera, yellow fever, and malaria, major communicable diseases that are still mass killers throughout the world because our government officials, on our behalf, develop public health measures to end those problems. We have been led to believe that government can't do anything right, often by people who don't believe in government, and then when they get into government, don't manage it well and prove their negative point. If we have people who believe in government, that it's the collective embodiment of people in a democracy, we can again solve big problems like ending hunger.
Well, there, I think we'll have to leave it. Again, if you're interested in reading about this issue, you can look at the book that we have mentioned. The title is All You Can Eat, How Hungry Is America? It's published by Seven Stories Press, came out last fall, is available in paperback, so it's not particularly expensive. You can look for it in the bookstore or at the library. And the author is our guest, Joel Berg. He's a nationally known leader in the fields of hunger and food security. He is now the executive director of the New York City Coalition Against Hunger. And again, if you'd like to find out about the coalition and its activities, they are on the web. So if you have internet access, you can look them up. And Mr. Berg, we want to say to you, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you so much.